Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
The thriller Blackrock, co-written by Mark Duplass, stars Katie Asselton, Lake Bell, and Kate Bosworth, and is available on demand during its theatrical release. Pieta is also available on demand while it's still in theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
This episode is also brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code SVU5.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And this time on SVU, find out whether we'll shower praise or scorn on Lee Daniels' soapy murder mystery, The Paperboy.
Yes, Streaming Video Unit has never been a more appropriate title for this show.
Yes.
Before that, we'll bring you Q-Shots, our look at some of the current offerings on various streaming and VOD sites, all centered around a common theme. Inspired by The Paperboy, we were tempted to do a podcast about the films of Zac Efron, but after we consulted with our attorneys, they determined that would technically be a violation of the restraining order Mr. Efron has against Allison. So don't worry, Allison. We'll get that lifted someday, and he will star in your screenplay, The Notebook, but starring Zac Efron and Allison Wilmore.
It's very good work.
It is. I actually was impressed.
Thank you.
It was better than I expected it to be. But nevertheless, instead, we're going to look at some more movies like The Paperboy that feature great moments in over-the-top acting. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable titles that are new on demand on cable. Allison, what's our picks this week?
First off, it's starting on May 21st, is the Zellner Brothers' Kid Thing, which will be new on VOD. The Zellners are Austin-based filmmakers and very nice guys who maybe are best known for their short films, which they've been making for years together. This is their second feature film. The first was Goliath. This one premiered at Sundance last year and is now finally just coming out. It's an interesting film about a little girl who spends a lot of her time alone, played by Sydney Aguirre. Annie is the name of the character. And it's a study of kind of how children entertain themselves in a way. She's 10 years old. She's very neglected, and she's almost like part feral sometimes. She goes and like attacks a birthday party at one point and steals a present from the girl. But the film also revolves around this really interesting and very dark scenario in which Annie finds a well that has a woman trapped in it, this kind of hole in the ground. And this woman tries to ask her to find help and kind of bargains with her. And she doesn't seem particularly interested in helping this woman. Mm-hmm. She brings her, food sometimes and throws some things in. She kind of talks to her, and this woman is like her companion. But she doesn't save the woman. And it's not just like a portrait of kind of child psychopathy. It's nothing that easy, because sometimes you wonder if the woman is actually there. Yeah. But also, it's the way that she kind of has the cruelty that children can just have, where you don't really have a sense of like the right and wrong in place yet, where you're just kind of toying with this woman who's trapped the way you would ants that are burning.
Thank you for calling AAA Auto Parts. Your quality is our top priority. How can I help you?
You broke my car.
Excuse me?
You broke my car.
You broke your car?
Y-E-S. Yes.
What are you talking about?
You broke my car.
Yeah, I get that. Who is this?
Your worst nightmare.
What kind of car is it?
A Lamborghini.
Lamborghini?
Did I stutter?
So it's a really interesting portrayal of a child, and it's got a really well done performance from the lead actress, who is not cute. She is not like your typical kind of adorable child performance. It's something very, it's much more challenging. So it's a really interesting film, and I'm glad that it's finally coming out on VOD. That is starting on May 21st.
I've seen that movie twice, actually, and I really like it. I think this is one, it's worth checking out. I would definitely encourage listeners to check it out. Yeah, it's not an easy film. It's not, you know, it certainly doesn't hit the obvious sort of like cute kid coming of age notes at all. It's kind of the opposite of that, but a very interesting movie. The Zellners are in it themselves, and they,
yes,
they're really funny. They're sort of the comic relief, and they're hilarious. And the end of that movie is amazing.
Yes.
I mean, it is a punch in the gut of an ending, but it is fabulous.
Yes.
Fabulous ending. One of the best endings in a while. It'll just kind of leave you kind of just sitting there like speechless, I think. So yeah, I definitely recommend Kid Thing.
Yeah. Also coming to VOD on May 28th is Laura, directed by Kate Shortland. I think I was pronouncing it Lore before, but
it's
actually
spelled L-O-R-E.
Yes.
If people are looking on their VOD listings.
Exactly.
Okay.
And Shortland is an Australian filmmaker. She did 2004's Somersault, which was a kind of breakout role for Abbie Cornish. And seems to have a gift for finding, you know, promising leading ladies. The lead actress in this, Saskia Rosendahl, is getting a lot of attention for her role as the title character. So it's about five siblings in Germany, just after World War II, who are traveling the country to get to their grandmother's house. Their parents are in the Nazi party and just disappeared rather than face, you know, the consequences of after the war. And they meet up with a concentration camp survivor who kind of ends up helping them as they're, you know, going across this war-ravaged country. And it's gotten a lot of, it's attracted a lot of critical praise.
I've heard a lot of good things about this movie.
Yeah. Also new on demand, as we mentioned in our intro, is Black Rock, which is directed by and stars Katie Asselton. It's co-written by her husband and The League co-star, Mark Duplass. It also stars Lake Bell and Kate Bosworth. And the two of them, along with Katie Asselton, play childhood friends who meet up to go to an island that they used to go to when they were young. It's kind of a bonding slash reconnecting trip. But they run into these three hunters who are former soldiers who are out there, and then things start to go wrong after one of the characters kind of goes to hook up with one of the guys and then changes her mind. And then it becomes like Deliverance is one of the
Deliverance for girls
is what
the hilarious pull quote on the poster says.
Yes, and who wouldn't want to see that just from that pull quote, really?
Yeah. Honey, look, it's Deliverance for girls.
Yay!
The movie is supposed to be good, though. I think that's pretty silly of an ad, but
yeah,
the movie itself is supposed to be very good.
Yeah, and you know, it's always Katie Asselton is an interesting kind of up-and-coming filmmaker as well as an actress.
Yep.
And it's interesting to see a female-led take on a thriller like this, on a kind of survivalist thriller. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one to check out. And it's definitely a change of pace for both Asselton and for Duplass, who are known for their comedies much more. That is currently available on demand.
Allison, we're very pleased to have Shutterstock.com back as a sponsor for us on this episode of Film Spotting SVU. And at Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. You can choose from over 700,000 high-quality video clips, 2D animations, or 3D motion graphics, and they have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. They source these video clips from around the world, and they put them at your fingertips, and they come from many contributors who are professional filmmakers. And they review each video individually for content and quality before adding them to their library. They add 10,000 video clips each week. So every time you visit, you'll find something new.
Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to bring your projects to the next level. And they make it easy with search tools that allow you to drill down by category, by clip resolution, by contributor, and more. And you can save all of the clips as you find them to a clip box that allows you to access your selections anytime and share them with your team members. Shutterstock is a complete offering that includes excellent customer service and 24-hour support throughout the week. They have flexible pricing. You can choose between individual clips or video packs. You can download clips in HD or save them in standard definition or web formats, and they have a huge library of photos, vectors, icons, and infographic templates.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account without a credit card. You just start your account, you start using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and you save your video selections in your clip box, and once you decide to purchase, use offer code SVU5, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. So that's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code SVU5. And we thank Shutterstock for their support.
Who are you carrying all those bricks for, anyway? God? Is that it? God? Well, I tell you, let me give you a little inside information about God. God likes to watch. He's a prankster. Think about it. He gives man instincts. He gives you this extraordinary gift, and then what does he do? I swear, for his own amusement, his own private cosmic gag reel, he sets the rules in opposition. It's the goof of all time. Look, but don't touch. Touch, but don't taste. Taste, don't swallow. And while you're jumping from one foot to the next, what is he doing? He's laughing his sick f***ing ass off. He's a tight ass. He's a sadist. He's an absentee landlord. Worship that? Never.
Inspired by The Paperboy, we thought we'd take a look at other crazy performances in films. Now, this could mean a lot of things. I feel like there are some people who are just known for crazy performances. Mm-hmm. There are other people who are capable of surprise crazy performances, right, which sometimes is a bit more enjoyable.
Agreed.
Because,
agreed,
you know, it's like, oh, wow, here's this person I think about in very serious contexts suddenly acting crazy and chewing,
right,
on the scenery.
Right.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for Brad Pitt's role in 12 Monkeys for this. It's interesting that Brad Pitt, I think, can be a kind of boring leading man sometimes. I think he's a really handsome guy and he looks great on screen, but sometimes seems to have trouble anchoring a movie as the lead, but is really interesting in supporting roles a lot,
right,
of the time.
Or like, Burn After Reading is another one where he's kind of,
yeah,
verging on crazy.
Yeah,
maybe not quite as crazy.
A lot of fun.
And yes,
sometimes he seems to be dying for a chance to do really eccentric roles.
Right.
And 12 Monkeys may be the best example of that, where he is like twitching and crazy. His eyes point in different directions.
Right.
And he seems to have, you know, more life to him than he does often on screen.
And that's certainly true. But on the other hand, it can be fun to see someone who's crazy. You know, sometimes the people who are crazy a lot because they're sort of like the masters of it. So like a guy like Jack Nicholson, like, you know, he certainly hasn't done too much crazy stuff in recent years. But back in his heyday, you know, like that's what you were going to see a lot of the time was unleashed Jack, you know, The Shining, you know, with all his madness. I don't know if there's ever been a better crazy performance than Jack Nicholson in The Shining, which sadly is not really available for streaming, but...
Yeah, a lot of the kind of best choices for this were not available.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted to give a shout-out to Al Pacino, who really... He doesn't seem able to scale it down, really,
right,
these days.
Right.
He only can kind of go over the top.
Right.
I wanted to give a particular... shout out to an otherwise terrible movie, Jack and Jill, which has really this unbelievable Al Pacino performance in it as himself. It's hard to even put in context, you know. It's somehow it
he almost makes that movie worth watching single-handedly.
He does, and especially when he raps about Dunkachino.
Don't spoil it. Do not spoil what Al Pacino does at the end of this movie.
It's so good.
It is good.
It is good.
Another one that I would recommend, just the Al Pacino part, although that's not true. I would also recommend the Christopher Walken part, and it is available on streaming, but we're not going to give a full pick to it, is Gigli, the god-awful movie. Gigli,
right,
includes Al Pacino. At the end of the movie, he appears. He's like the guy who's hired Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez to do whatever they're doing in that movie, and they go to see him at the end, and he has this one incredibly long scene where he just escalates, and... It's just unbelievable how loud he gets. And I just remember, like, one of the lines he says is like, "You do not extort a federal effing prosecutor!" You know, and that's like him at an 8, and then he goes up to a 10 or a 12 or a 15 or a 100.
Right.
It's just crazy.
He starts at the 8, usually.
Right.
He doesn't necessarily do the slow burn.
No. Slow burn and Al Pacino are words that are not often used together. Or The Devil's Advocate's another great,
oh, great,
great crazy
one.
Al Pacino,
fantastic,
performance, but not on that one's not on Netflix, unfortunately.
Yeah. And some other kind of classic actors who are known for their, mm-hmm, for their ability to go big.
Yes.
Klaus Kinski.
Absolutely. He's probably maybe the most famous.
Right. Crispin Glover.
God. Yes.
Kirk Douglas. Jim Carrey. Especially.
Yep.
Michael Sheen in the Twilight movies does something,
oh,
really,
wow,
special, I think. He's There's a laugh that he does in the latest one that is worth... I think there's probably a clip on YouTube. In fact, I'm positive there is, and it's amazing.
It is transcendent.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I think that we've got a few picks here, and I feel like we're doing a mix of some that are kind of ridiculous performances and some that are
appropriately
ridiculous.
So let's before we get to the picks, in a very quickly, what makes a crazy performance acceptable? What makes it fit into a movie? How do you make a crazy performance work?
Well, I think that it's more about the movie than it is a performance at
right,
that point.
Right.
You know, like, if can a movie accommodate this performance? Does it make sense in the context? If you mm-hmm. feel like someone is basically ripping through the fabric of the movie with their performance, if it breaks... It consumes everyone else in the movie, I think mm-hmm. it's usually not a good performance, right? Or it's usually ridiculous because no one around it matches.
So you have to know your role, you have to know your movie, and you have to make sure that the movie is suitably large to accommodate a performance that large.
Yeah,
that,
I think so.
I think that's fair, yeah. I think that's very fair. All right, should we get to our picks?
Yeah.
You want to start? What's your first choice?
My first choice is one where I think it fits really well,
okay.
which is Bad Lieutenant. This is the 1992 film, but directed by Abel Ferrara, a man who knows his crazy very well. This is streaming on Netflix, as well as on Epic's streaming service and Redbox. You know, Harvey Keitel, not necessarily as prone to kind of jump at the chance to go big as some of his colleagues who came up at the same time, though he's boldly gone into full frontal nudity like few other male actors. Bad Lieutenant features a performance that just escalates into this kind of magnificent breakdown. And what works so well about it, as he plays his title character who smokes crack, does drugs, has threesomes, gambles heavily, drinks, is that it builds that he is a bad lieutenant from the beginning, but it kind of builds up to this scene in which he's investigating the rape of a nun, and he has this scene in a church where he has gone to talk to her and he wants to convince her that he's going to go after the guys who raped her, and she says she's forgiven them already. And it creates this moment in him where he just has this breakdown in the church, and he like curls up on the floor and he moans like a wounded animal, and it is this incredibly committed performance. You know, he's like yelling at God. And it works because it's like Keitel just puts ultimate trust in Ferrara in this. You know, he like surrenders to this vision.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't feel ridiculous because it's such this act of like commitment to what the movie is about. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a really good Keitel performance. And, you know, this is one of Ferrara's better films. It's really got much more of a sense of coherence than some of his other movies can, which they sometimes just ramble. And I think that it's a great use of someone just like building on this performance until it reaches this crescendo in a way that doesn't feel ridiculous or like so showy that you're aware of the acting.
Mm-hmm.
So that is Bad Lieutenant. It is currently streaming on Netflix.
It's an excellent pick, and I think we should just very briefly mention that there was right. a remake of Bad Lieutenant.
Even though its remake quality were kind of like debated by the two directors.
Yeah, it's sort of a demake. It's yes. like it has no bearing on the original film other than the title and the concept.
Yes.
But there is a crazy performance at the center of that movie as well, which we don't need to talk about because I suspect the man who gave that performance may come up.
I think he will.
A little later in the show. All right. Well, that's a great pick. I mean, just the definition of a great over-the-top performance, because it's crazy, but it works in that movie. My pick, I don't know if it works. I guess maybe it doesn't work quite as well. It's certainly not as good a movie. It's not as respected as that movie. But I have a really soft spot for this movie, and when I saw that it was on Netflix, I rewatched it. And I gotta say, I kind of like this movie. Maybe it's nostalgia, but it does have a great over-the-top performance in it. And it's Blue Chips from 1994 with Nick Nolte, another actor who's known for his intensity and he's sort of one of those guys who I think more than Keitel is like, he is kind of crazy in a lot of his movies, and certainly outside of the frame, he's known for being especially crazy, which he brings to a lot of his movies. And in this movie, he's basically playing Bobby Knight, the famous college basketball coach. He's playing this college basketball coach who's fiery and, as you know, quick-tempered and is very frustrated with the way that his program is kind of falling apart. And he's a man of high morals, but he so wants to win so badly that he compromises them by sort of succumbing to temptation and gaming the system and trying to buy players. And one of the players he finds and then kind of, you know, tries to convince to come to his university is Shaquille O'Neal, sort of a young Shaquille O'Neal playing. I believe his character's name is Neon Boudreau. His first name is Neon.
I like that.
It's kind of amazing when Shaquille O'Neal, whose name is Shaquille, plays a character whose name is crazier than Shaquille. That's kind of amazing. But Nolte is really, really great in this movie, and it does fit the role. I mean, if you've seen Bobby Knight, I'm sure if you went on YouTube and you like typed in Bobby Knight outburst or Bobby Knight crazy or something like that, you would see some really insane things that Bobby Knight did on the court in real life. You know, when he would lose his temper, he would lose his mind. And Nolte really goes for it. He apparently like shadowed Bobby Knight for a while to learn about him, to sort of capture him in the performance. And even though he's not playing quote unquote Bobby Knight, he does a great job of playing that type of guy. And his introduction in this movie is great, where it's basically his halftime speech to his players, and he's like introduced storming into the locker room and just screaming and cursing and throwing things. I mean, just the number of things he destroys. In the first scene alone, he destroys a water cooler, the base of the water cooler. He's throwing chairs. He's screaming. He's cursing at these guys.
Honest to Christ, you boys, the only joy I have right now is I only have to watch you guys play two more games. God damn it!
It's fantastic. And then at the end of the movie, I won't spoil what happens, but he gives like this very long speech, kind of like it reminds me a little of Pacino in The Devil's Advocate, where it's just all screaming, you know, or that's not true. That one starts, he starts lower. It's a slower burn. But when he burns at the top, he's burning at like, you know, the fire of a sun or something like that. Just way over the top. It's great. It's great. And the movie doesn't have a great reputation. You know, it's from like that era when Friedkin was kind of just doing like work for hire roles, but I find something very likable and watchable about this movie. I think it's worth watching. Certainly it's worth watching for Nick Nolte's over-the-top performance. So that's Blue Chips, and it is available on Netflix.
All right, my next pick is also a blue movie. It is Blue Velvet.
I love how we did that. It's unbelievable.
It's amazing, the themes that we find here. Blue Velvet, currently streaming on, or currently for rent on Amazon, iTunes, and Vudu. Written and directed by David Lynch, 1986 film. And, you know, in this case, it's really defined in many ways by this performance from Dennis Hopper, who has been known to go over the top. You know, you can look back at his immortal turns as the villains in Waterworld and Super Mario Brothers, two highlights of his career. May he rest in peace. You know, this film, it has this, I mean, the performance that Hopper gives is this, like, just crazy, like, black hole of a performance. It's amazing. And the film is remarkable in being able to accommodate it. It makes perfect sense in this, like, dreamlike noir of the film. You know, Lynch is a master at creating this very, these very untrustworthy realities that have dream logic. And I think one of the things that makes Hopper's Frank Booth such the ideal monster in this kind of story of a small town's seedy underbelly is that everyone else has these touches of darkness to them, including the main character, who's the boy detective, you know, played by Kyle MacLachlan, if everyone has those darknesses in them, then you have to have someone who is this tornado, basically, to have him be like the real frightening character. And he is. I mean, the scene with the gas mask, the kind of famous scene, is so disturbing just because you have no idea what's going on, you know? Like, it's filled with kind of actual violence, but also this weird emotional violence. You don't, like, and the fact that Frank Booth is frightening and violent, but also like kind of capable of switching in a second to being like maudlin and sad, is something that makes him more frightening. Like he's like the worst, scariest bar drunk, right? Like the guy at the bar who's like at one moment is like sobbing over the song, you know, on the radio, and then next moment like smashing a glass in someone's face.
It's Blue Velvet.
Yeah, and
I can see that. That's a good comparison.
Yeah, it's a great performance from Hopper, and I think it also speaks to Lynch's ability to create a particularly twisted reality that it doesn't just break the movie in half.
He also seems legitimately unhinged at times. Like, he doesn't seem like he's playing crazy.
Right.
He seems crazy.
Yeah, it's so committed.
Yeah.
It's something, and I think it's part of the reason it works so well, is that, like, it doesn't seem actorly at all. It seems genuinely off. Like, you would be frightened to be on set with Dennis Hopper in that movie, which I think is, I mean, that's a remarkable bit. That's a remarkable performance. It speaks to that. And, you know, it holds up so well. Like, this movie in general, I think, it holds up incredibly well. And Hopper in particular, in going so over the top, has created something very memorable. Mm-hmm. So that's Blue Velvet. It is currently for rent on Amazon, iTunes, and Vudu.
That's a great pick. My next pick is another interesting combination of director. You know, like, we couldn't figure out how to get Kinski and Herzog in here, mm-hmm. and they were such a great example of, like, a really volatile actor who was just, like, pushed to new heights by a great director. And I feel like this is another pairing, not quite as good as that one, maybe, but I think a similar kind of vibe, where you have a really inspired, really dedicated, really crazy, intense performer who was pushed to great heights of madness by a great director, and that would be John Waters and Divine. And the film that I'm picking here is Female Trouble from 1974. It's available on Amazon and Vudu. And it was funny, when I mentioned to somebody last night at a bar that we were doing this podcast, and this was our topic, and I was going to do one with Divine, they're like, oh, you're going to do Pink Flamingos.
Right.
And I was like, actually, I'm going to do Female Trouble. And Pink Flamingos is maybe not a great film, but a fascinating film and an interesting film and a fun film and a crazy film.
Right.
And Divine is certainly crazy in that. And the famous thing at the end of the movie is that Divine eats dog crap.
Yes.
Like, literally a dog poops on screen.
It's a take, yeah.
Yeah, it's all in long, it's like one long thing. The dog poops, Divine walks over, scoops it up, puts it in her mouth.
Yeah.
And that is like the definition of crazy, basically.
Right.
But somehow, Female Trouble, her performance as Dawn Davenport, is like somehow even crazier. And if you made a list of the crazy things that Divine does in this movie, we could literally be sitting here all night talking about them. I mean, Divine literally has sex with herself. She plays both parts of this sex scene.
It's a great scene.
this guy and he plays, you know, Divine, and also this guy who picks Dawn Davenport up on the side of the road, and they have kind of like disgusting sex on the side of a road on like a soiled mattress, and Divine is playing both parts. What else? There's this amazing nightclub performance at the end of the movie where she's jumping on a trampoline, but not well, not gracefully, like falling over and like strutting and screaming and touching herself and making these lewd gestures, and then takes out a gun and starts shooting at the audience.
Thank you. I love you. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my black little heart. You came here for some excitement tonight, and that's just what you're going to get. Take a good look at me, because I'm going to be on the front of every newspaper in this country tomorrow. You're looking at crime personified, and don't you forget it!
I mean, this is to me is like the epitome of over the top, but in a context that works. I mean, it is a John Waters movie, so everything is heightened, you know, and everyone is crazy. And so it's just a mesmerizing performance. You know, again, she starts as sort of this like troubled, kind of deadbeat, delinquent teen. And we see her rise to, I don't know, greatness. I don't know what. I mean, by the end of the movie, Divine, her face has been scarred by acid. She's mainlining eyeliner which is in this world of madness is sort of like a drug, like heroin. She like shoots it into her veins. She's got this crazy mohawk, this unbelievably over the top makeup on her face, wearing these outrageous outfits, and just constantly like, I mean, it's so manic, it is so over the top, but it is so fabulous. I mean, there are just scenes where you're just mesmerized by the power and the magnetism of this performance. I really love Female Trouble. I mean, Pink Flamingos is the most famous one, and everyone knows the dog poop scene and all that, but I love Female Trouble. That's my favorite. Well, maybe it's my, I don't know. I like a lot of John Waters movies, but if you're looking for a performer going over the top in the most delicious way possible, I recommend Female Trouble. It's available for rent on Amazon and Vudu.
I'm a big fan of Female Trouble as well. And it is also, I mean, Pink Flamingos has a bit more of a stunt aspect to it, whereas it's like a performance. It really defines Female
Trouble.
There is
some stunty aspects. There's a lot of like really kind of horrifying sex scenes in Female Trouble. There's a lot of attempts to shock. But I think there's a little bit more kind of a nuanced is definitely not the right word, but there's a bit more of like a pointed kind of comedy there. It's, you know, like the satire is a little funnier.
Yeah.
There are characters that are clearly like you can tell their jokes instead of it's sort of like so crazy you laugh, you
know? Right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, my next film is it's a slightly different type of film than the first two I mentioned. It is the classic 1997 film Con Air.
Oh, God. Yeah. You have been so excited
to
talk about
this. It was the first
movie.
One. I'm like, now I'm going to talk about it much more than films by Abel Ferrara and David Lynch. It's available for rent on Amazon, iTunes, YouTube, Google Play, and other services. Directed by Simon West. It was his directorial debut. Produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, of course. And, you know, we had to pick a Nicolas Cage film here.
We had
really,
to.
Like,
we had
there's
no choice.
Way we could talk about this topic without including Nicolas Cage.
Right.
And like Cameron Poe is hardly Cage's nuttiest role.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's possible to really pick one nutty role. Maybe Neil LaBute's The Wicker Man. That's got a pretty great acceleration into madness in it.
Yes.
And a lot of like hitting and punching of women.
To be fair, Allison, he doesn't punch all of them. Some of them he kicks in the
neck.
That's
true. Okay. Lily Sobieski, I think he gets drop kicked. Anyway, but, you know, like, Con Air was really made at this tipping point in Cage's career. Leaving Las Vegas was 1995, right? The Rock was 1996, and Con Air was 1997. And kind of after this point, he was like, he was Nicolas Cage as we know him today.
In all
really.
Caps.
Yes. And, you know, in both The Rock and Con Air, he does this interesting thing where he's almost like doing an impression of a leading man as like maybe one who suffered a serious head injury.
Yeah.
Like there's something just off about it. In The Rock as well. I mean, The Rock is a very enjoyable, like big action film,
yep.
But he's really weird in The Rock as well. And he's really weird as Cameron Poe in this film. He's got this like magnificent mullet. He's supposed to be, you know, like he's this good guy who's gone to jail for this kind of this unfortunate accident, but he's done his time and he's going to finally be reunited with his family. And it's just such a, like, it's played fairly straight in the most ridiculous way. I don't remember the part where he, like, someone's digging through his stuff and finds, like, the proof that he's actually been released. He's not an actual prisoner anymore. He's like, they have the standoff where he's, like, looking at the bunny that he's bought for, the stuffed rabbit he's bought for his child.
Yeah. Put the bunny back in the box.
I knew you was a punk, and I was right. You were playing us all along. You a free man.
I said, put the bunny back in the box.
And then, like, you know, escalates it, and then there's a fight. And but, you know, I think the thing that makes this movie a really enjoyable bit of, like, main, like, studio flotsam is the fact that it's just like a symphony of actors offering their craziest selves.
There's a lot of
you
crazy.
Know? Like every edition of a new character is like crazier than the next.
Yeah.
You know, John Malkovich as Cyrus the Virus Grissom is an equally crazy performance. It may be actually crazier than Cage's performance in this film because he just chews the scenery relentlessly. He also uses them. I think there's one part where he says like the bunny is gonna, he like threatens the bunny as well, this stuffed rabbit. I mean, there he makes makes fun of like the letter like Cage's character received and reads it in this high voice because it's supposed to be the kid. Like, it's a ridiculous, ridiculous performance from Malkovich, who can also do crazy, has been known to do crazy. You know, you've got Danny Trejo as serial rapist Johnny 23, Steve Buscemi as Garland Green, who's kind of the poor man's Hannibal Lecter, and like presented as kind of adorable, right? Like, he's like, he becomes like a kind of good, potential good guy, even though he's like beheaded all these women. Like, and Dave Chappelle is in there even. If you remember this, he sets one on fire, gets thrown out of a plane. The only one who isn't acting completely over the top, ironically, considering our main review,
yes,
is John Cusack.
Yeah.
Who plays like maybe the only recognizable,
cop, right?
Yeah, like kind of ridiculous, but like recognizable human being,
yeah,
as opposed to everyone else who is, I don't know what they're doing there, but this movie is so ridiculous and stupid that it's a lot of fun. And I think just the fact that like everyone in the movie has been told that they are divine, you know, in their own personal prison plane movie, makes it a pretty enjoyable kind of artifact of the era. That is Con Air. It's available for rent on Amazon, iTunes, YouTube, and other places.
All right. Well, our last pick is an obvious one, but really, how could we not mention it? How could we not include it? It's one of the all-time, maybe not great, but memorable, crazy, over-the-top performances, probably in a movie. I mean, it's hard to say. Like, I'm sitting here trying to think, is this a role where it fits the movie? No, not at all.
No.
But the thing is, it consumes the movie whole.
It defines it.
Exactly. Thank you. It defines the movie completely. And that's Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford in Mommy Dearest, directed by Frank Perry, and it's available on Amazon, Google Play, Vudu, and YouTube for rent. And this is basically one of the strangest mainstream Hollywood movies, I think, of all time, because it's basically about how horrible a movie star is. You know, this great movie star from Hollywood's golden age, Joan Crawford, and it's based on this memoir that was written by her daughter, who hated her mother and basically wanted to get back at her mother for what she thought was a horrible, painful childhood by writing this seedy tell-all memoir, which was then turned into this even more seedy, even more a tragic biopic, I guess, starring Faye Dunaway in this role. And all she does in this movie is be crazy. It's just totally over the top in a way that I think has come to be seen as kind of just wonderfully trashy and tragic and defining commitment in a way that is just like really a bad idea. This was a bad idea from start to finish, but it's so unbelievably committed that you sort of kind of begrudgingly admire the committedness of it, even as you're like chuckling at the sheer over-the-top nature of it. I mean, just scene after scene of Faye Dunaway with all this schmutz on her face, screaming at her daughter.
Wire hangers.
No wire hangers. Throwing wire hangers at her, waking her up in the middle of the night to, I think, chop down a tree. It's been a while since I've seen this one. I didn't have a chance to rewatch it, but I remember chopping down a tree in the middle of the night. I remember her challenging her to races in a pool, and like to the point of exhaustion. She's just horrible. She's a horrible woman, and she's insane. She's completely insane.
No wire hangers! What's wire hangers doing in this closet when I told you no wire hangers ever? Work till I'm half dead, and I hear people saying she's getting old. What do I get? A daughter who cares as much about the beautiful dresses I give her as she cares about me. What's wire hangers doing in this closet? Answer me!
The movie makes no attempt, really, to redeem her or justify her behavior. She's a horrible person, and it is fascinating to watch. And it's not a good movie, but it is an amazingly weird and over-the-top performance. One of the defining crazy over-the-top performances in the history of movies. I don't know what else needs to be said here. I mean, it's just, if you've never seen Mommy Dearest, it really is a sight to behold. I mean, I wouldn't expect a great movie, but I would expect a memorable movie and a memorable performance from Faye Dunaway. That's available on Amazon, Google Play, Vudu, and YouTube.
Take hands with the Smothers Brothers.
Oh, no, this is a show.
Oh, love that show. I love Dick and I love Tommy.
Lay down. Let me be you for a second.
Oh, yeah, right. Give me a shot.
Oh, you want me to meet? I'll get to meet you. Okay.
Jack.
Okay, I love this.
Jack, may I come in? Oh, good. Okay.
You want to go back up?
Okay.
I better start drinking off first. Okay.
Jack, sorry to interrupt your masturbation, but I'm here to clean your bed.
I'm going to be jacking off.
Oh, I'm going to clean everything.
I'm going to be jacking off.
Allison, there's no ballot box stuffing or hanging chads or really chicanery of any kind in our listeners' choice reviews. We pick the three titles we're most interested in talking about, and from there we let the will of the mob decide. You know, we might sometimes prefer one movie over another, but generally we don't campaign, we don't beg listeners to vote the way we want them to, but I kind of wish we had this week. We gave them three choices. We gave you guys three choices to choose from. You had Sun Don't Shine, which was this indie noir from this up-and-coming director, Amy Simons, that I'm really looking forward to seeing. I know you are, too. We also gave our listeners the choice of I Spit on Your Grave, a movie I'm not really looking forward to seeing, but I was curious about. I'd never seen a famous movie and probably an interesting one to discuss. And last but least, The Paperboy. And we were hoping, I think, for Sun Don't Shine. And we were resigned, I think, to I Spit on Your Grave. But audience, you guys really wanted to hear us talk about Lee Daniels' swampy Florida noir starring Zac Efron as a college dropout and former swimming champion who, along with his older brother Ward, played by Matthew McConaughey, investigate the conviction of a death row inmate in order to determine whether he is innocent of the crime. The movie also stars John Cusack as Hillary Van Wetta, who is the alligator hunter turned death row convict, and Macy Gray as Efron's family's maid, who narrates the story from some point after the events, and also Nicole Kidman, Nicole Kidman's hair, Nicole Kidman's crazy southern accent, and Nicole Kidman's urinary tract as Charlotte Bless, a lonely woman who writes letters to prisoners and connects via the post with Hillary, becomes engaged to him through the mail service, and then, the first time they meet in person, pleasures herself while he stares and grunts at her and touches himself from across the room. The Aristocrats! Now, Allison, when we proposed The Paperboy as a listener's choice option on our last episode, you said that while you didn't enjoy the movie the first time you saw it, you did think there was a lot there to say about it. Now, having seen it a second time, something I was pretty sure I was never going to do, what exactly do you think there is in this crazy movie that is worth having a conversation about?
Well, I think that one of the things is just the performances, particularly Nicole Kidman's. Mm-hmm. You know, we picked the theme for this, like the larger theme for this episode for a reason, which is that this film has Kidman in a role that really is very little like the one she often plays, which is like she plays these kind of aristocratic or these like glacial, these regal characters. And here she is just like a Southern belle gone wrong in a lot of ways. She's very sexual. She's extremely kind of, you know, like not just like promiscuous, but like sexuality is something like this, like definitive to her character, right? Like it is how she approaches the world. She kind of flirts with everyone and sleeps with several of the characters. And it's just like a kind of amazing performance as much as it is also hard to grapple with. Like the movie doesn't seem to justify that kind of committed performance, you know? Like the movie itself is so incoherent. We were talking before we recorded this about the central kind of mystery in the film that it starts off with, which is that this corrupt, abusive local sheriff was murdered.
Right.
And, you know, Hillary was
John Cusack's character is the guy who's convicted.
Right, is convicted, and they're looking to free him by saying, like, this trial is obviously unfair,
right,
and all of that. And it seems like he probably didn't do it, but we never find out who did, if that's the case. It just goes away. Like, the whole mystery aspect of it just dribbles away.
Yeah, I'd like to formally and publicly apologize to Top of the Lake for everything bad I said about the murder mystery, or the mystery in that story. Because this movie makes Top of the Lake look like, I don't know, Chinatown or something. Like, the mystery aspect of this movie is so horrible. But anyway, continue. I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, you know, you have just also John Cusack's performance, which is even
Hilary Van Wetter.
It's just crazy. It is utterly crazy.
He's kind of channeling John Voight in Anaconda, where he's like,
yeah,
he's very
that.
Slicked. His hair is slicked back, and he's leathery, and like he like associates with. He's like an alligator hunter, or he skins alligators, or whatever he does, and he like seems to look kind of like an alligator, sort of like how John Voight channels snakes in that movie.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's to the benefit of the movie, but
it's another very committed performance.
It's committed.
You know, and I think that the part that I will say is just works about this movie is the weird and kind of like uncomfortable physicality of it. Like, I don't know maybe any other movie that this has this amount of like bodily fluids in it, even, you know, like not just the urine in the infamous scene of peeing.
Yes.
Or the semen that stains the pants of John Cusack after his prison encounter that everyone witnesses.
Yeah.
Or the blood that a certain character sits in a pool of.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even the alligator guts that we are treated to a scene with.
The alligator guts.
Or it's just like everyone is covered with sweat all the time, too. You know, everyone is like, it's hot, it's a Florida summer, and everyone is just like glistening all the time. Like, there is a sense of like, just the actual physicality of all of these characters in a way that I think is pretty rare in a film, and just like the kind of animalness of a lot of them, you know, like the romance, if you want to call it that, between Charlotte Bless and Hillary is like just so animal. Like, they not like the prison encounter scene, and then a later one is just like they're both like. There's something like almost not human about the way they grapple with each other. And it's, I don't know that I've really ever seen that. Not that I know that I was dying to see that.
Right.
But, you know, it is unusual and I think disturbing and in a way that is impressive. And most other aspects of the film do not work for me at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a movie that I feel like I should like there's a
why there,
well just the way I mean there's something about Lee Daniels as a director that I admire, even if I don't like it, just because he goes for broke, you know. He's willing to do things that other people don't do. He's willing to put these things on screen and at least attempt to tackle them, attempt to talk about them, not just sex, but there's, you know, there's stuff about race in this movie and about the era, the politics of the era, and the social mores of the era that, you know, a lot of filmmakers just wouldn't want to touch, you know? And like you said, there's something very tactile about this movie and upfront about it. It doesn't shy away from the seedier elements of this movie and this story. And to a certain respect, I begrudgingly admire that about it. But his touch is so awkward and blunt and in your face and so just random. I mean, there's no elegance to this movie whatsoever about the story. Like we said, the murder mystery is terrible. It's like, what is this movie about ultimately? Yeah. Is it about the mystery? Is it about the character of Zac Efron, who's like coming of age in this very seedy, corrupt world? It seemingly not, because he's not really the center of it. You know, like, he's totally overwhelmed by the crazy characters around him. You know, is it about race in the late 1960s in Florida? Because there's a few characters where race plays a very big role, including Macy Gray's character, the maid, and also Ward's, Matthew McConaughey's writing partner, Yardley. You know, his character is, like, really angry.
Yes, and just,
super
like,
angry.
And it's such a weird character.
He's
like,
British.
Yeah.
We won't say any more than that, but he, you know, he's walking around with this really haughty attitude, you know, not entirely undeserved because he's treated poorly by everyone in this world with a few exceptions, but just, it's so, you know, it's like there's no sense of perspective or it's just, everything is so extreme, you know, that's the thing. It's like there's no modulation.
Base level, yeah.
There's no base level. I just walk out of this movie so just like kind of like depressed.
I did an interview with Lee Daniels once. It was for the movie he produced. I don't remember what it was called, starring Mariah Carey. But I asked him one question. He had me on speaker and I asked him one question. And it was like your typical opening softball, like, you know, tell me about how you ended up being a producer on this movie. And then he talked for half an hour.
Oh my God.
Just like about how he how he came into movies and like in general about how he's like, you know, I directed Shadowboxer. And people took it so seriously and I didn't mean for people to take it. And so like, and on. And I felt like actually that whole experience was exemplary, like, of like how he approaches his films as well, which is, I think, he just kind and he just like whatever strikes his mind at the time goes in, and
no,
I think,
filter whatsoever.
No filter whatsoever. And I think you feel that a lot in The Paperboy. Yeah. It's just like whatever idea he had at the moment just happened.
Yeah,
like the peeing scene, but it's filmed in such a weird way because it's there's like music playing. And Zac Efron and Nicole Kidman are on the beach, mm-hmm. and they're kind of flirting. Flirting seems much more delicate for what they're doing. She's like, "You want me to give you a blowjob, don't you?" And then he like gets angry and stalks into the water and swims, and then finds himself in the middle of jellyfish. And the music kind of like cuts out in and out. Like there's something. It's filmed. Like it's suddenly an experimental film, you know, like it's like the footage cuts in and out, and then like there's characters on the beach looking at him, and then he like flops onto the shore and he's like covered with welts, and Nicole Kidman's character is like furious that other girls are coming to help him,
right?
And none of it makes any sense. Like it just, it has no, there's no connection to like what the reality is supposed to be of the scene at all, you know? Like, is it a memory? Is it, why is it shot that way? Like, there's no coherence to it at all.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And I think a lot of the movie has that approach.
Yeah. I mean, that scene is funny because it's so crazy, you know? And the fact that, like, not only is it, you know, a scene that's about Nicole Kidman peeing on Zac Efron's face, like, we see it happen. Like, it's pretty graphic.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like there's a cutaway, right? At, like, or a zoom in on her face as she struggles to pee. There's a zoom in on the stream as it exits the body, you know, like that is what he's doing. And I think you've kind of hit it. You know, this idea that he just stream of consciousness. There's this interesting quote. I was looking at a few different reviews of the movie online this morning, and I found this interesting quote from Wesley Morris, who reviewed this movie for the Boston Globe. Now he works for Grantland, and he actually likes this movie a lot, or at least a lot more than me, and he sort of admired the craziness of it. But here was a line from near the end of his review, and he says, "I've never seen a movie like this, not on purpose. Daniels isn't saying he's tasteful. He's saying that his tasteless trash is as deserving of our attention as the tasteless trash we feel like we have to see. The whole thing's a crazy fantasy, like watching a porno dream it can win an Oscar." And I think that's an interesting description, but I feel like that's part of the problem for me, is that the movie, while it's trashy, it also seems to have these aspirations of Oscardom. And I don't feel like they serve the movie well, like Wesley Moore says. I feel like they really bring the movie down. You know, if it was really trashy, if it was Showgirls trash, I feel like it would be fun. But the movie isn't fun to me. You know, like, it's trying so hard to say something, which it doesn't know what, but about race, about this time and place, about homosexuality, which is a big kind of buried theme throughout the movie, that you can't really have fun with the crazy scenes because in the next scene there's some horrific violence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that particularly the storyline that you're kind of mentioning,
I don't
which is like
spoil,
a character
but
who kind of has this, like, his homosexuality
is
revealed.
A closeted homosexual.
Yeah. And it is like, it's a really disturbing scene. Like the whole thing that happens, and it just kind of, like, when it arises, after, like, you've kind of had suspicions about this character, but when it happens, like, the way it's revealed is so graphic and disturbing and, like, goes wrong. Yeah. And it's so abrupt. It's not...
And kind of effective for what it's doing.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's butting up against these other scenes that are so silly and over the top and trashy that it's just, you know, it doesn't... They just don't fit together at all.
Yeah. And I think, though, I will say that the one, like, relationship I really liked in the film, though there's no real reason, like, I don't know why Macy Gray's character narrates the film. It starts off with this framing device that she is talking about the book that Zac Efron's character wrote about this. Never really comes back to that. There's no reason for it to even have that framing in the beginning that never ends. But I think that her relationship with Zac Efron's character is actually really sweet. Like, it's the only kind of human-seeming relationship in the film, because she's kind of like a mother figure to him, even though she's not really old enough to be, you know, his mother. They have like this real kind of like funny way that they kind of tussle with each other, basically, and like bicker, and she cares about him and kind of tries to, and like, you know, in terms of like as a take on this very kind of classic and like, you know, stereotype of like the black maid in cinema.
Yeah.
It's a, like an interesting and like almost a rebuke of it, because she's like a very real character who understands that like she cares about him a lot, but also that she's just an employee. And there's a really nice kind of scene with them towards the end that I thought was, you know, actually well done.
Yeah. I mean, I think their scenes, and also really all the scenes with Macy Gray and interacting with the family,
yeah,
I think are pretty effective. And they seemed, I don't know, you know, if that's something that Lee Daniels is channeling from his own life in some way, or someone he knows, or a relative perhaps that that character is based on. But it really did seem to get at something truthful, yeah, and honest. Whereas the rest, but again, those scenes are kind of almost minimal and like sort of like very small observations about what it was like, you know, for these just so casually racist white people, the way they treat her,
right,
is so horrible.
Well, but she's also like such a part of their lives in the
right,
same way. Yeah.
Right. So you have that, but then that's butting up against, you know, like the scene in the jail with Nicole Kidman and John Cusack snarling at each other, like you said, like animals, you know. It's, I don't know. It's such a mess. I mean, the other thing that I think is sort of interesting, although I don't, you know, I think it needed a better actor, even though I know you love Zac Efron. I mean, I know you've written the screenplay and all
right,
that
right,
about him, but, you know, he's a handsome guy. I mean, like, and the movie is really, it really delights in him.
Oh, yeah. I'd say, like, it objectifies him possibly more than it does Nicole Kidman.
I mean, he's certainly, his body is on display more than hers.
Yeah, he likes to lounge around in his, like, white underwear
in his skivvies,
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I found something interesting about that just because that doesn't, you know, like, especially with a guy like Zac Efron, who's sort of grown up as a Disney star, where, you know, his handsomeness or his sexuality is sort of, it's there, but it's so buried beneath, you know, all the layers of Disney-ness.
Yeah.
I found something sort of interesting about the fact that the movie is really in love with him.
Yeah.
And really shows him. I mean, there are a lot. There's one other scene later in the movie where he is wearing another guy's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Yardley's clothes. And then he comes in. He's like, why are you wearing my clothes? Take off my clothes. And then he just strips out of his clothes.
Yeah.
And he's naked
and he goes
again.
And sits in the rain.
And then he goes sits in the rain without any clothes on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I mean, I found something sort of admirable about the sort of the male gaze instead of like, you know, or the female gaze, I guess. Or I don't know what you would call
it. Like, the male gaze, right?
It's a different male gaze.
It's a different male gaze, yeah.
So there's something about that. But Zac Efron, maybe it's just the fact that everyone else is so crazy that his sort of his performance is just kind of washed away. But he's not very charismatic.
No, and you know, I don't know that I've seen enough of him to say that he's either a good or bad actor. I don't think he's a particularly good actor. He's not terrible in this. Like, he's not egregiously bad.
No.
But he is lacking charisma compared to, like, everyone else on screen.
Right. The only thing that's memorable about him here is his body, basically.
Right. And I maybe another problem in the film is that it tries to make like an almost romance between, like, he's like fixated on Nicole Kidman's
which is
character
ridiculous.
Which makes
yeah.
no sense also because, like, she is so crazy from the beginning. Like, she you know, other than like looking like Nicole Kidman, she walks in and she's just
right, but
nuts. Like,
she looks like Nicole Kidman now. I mean,
it's
exactly. absurd. It's
but,
totally
like,
absurd.
You know, and like it's supposed to be like he kind of falls for her instantly.
He's obsessed
but she's
with her.
So crazy
yeah.
right away.
Yeah.
And also they have like a scene together and it's funny that the movie like pulls back. It's like, I think you've seen enough of this, and like tastefully like pulls back and you're like, excuse me, we've just watched her pee on his face. Now you're like in good taste.
I think restraint is called
yeah,
for
exactly.
here. Guys, don't be pervy about it. All right, let them have their dignified moment together.
Exactly. And it's just it's that it never really can manage that relationship at
yeah.
all.
All right. Well, I hope you're happy, listeners.
Well, I would love if someone has like a defense of this movie, I would love to hear it because I think it is like a completely crazy and in that way unique movie. But I don't think
movie.
That it works all that well.
No,
but I would
no.
love to hear someone make an impassioned defense of
sure.
it.
Sure. Send us your feedback about The Paperboy. If you love it, SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. That's our email address. Send us your comments about it. We'd love to hear it. I would, too. And some people like this movie. You know, Wesley Morris, if you want to find Wesley Morris's review of this movie, he's very positive on it. He liked it. There were other people who kind of admired the craziness of it. We were less enamored. But anyway, that's The Paperboy, and it's available on Netflix. All right, it's time now for Behind the Eight Ball, where we wrap up the show with three new releases, two expiring titles, and one film chosen blindly from our Netflix queue. There is a problem here, though, Allison.
There is a
because
problem.
Since we last spoke with you guys, Netflix has decided to sort of make invisible all of their data about expiring titles. I think when all those titles expired on what was colloquially referred to as Streamageddon, they got some bad press. They weren't too happy about that. And I suspect, although I don't know for sure, that they decided that it wasn't worth having this information out there for people to know. So they've pulled back all their expiring information. So we don't know what's expiring now. So on this episode, we're basically just going to do our three new releases and our one random pick. And we want to figure out how we can replace the expiring section for our next episode. We would love to hear from you guys what you would like in that space. You can email us, again, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. We were thinking we could do, like, three Netflix titles and then two titles from other services like Hulu and Crackle and Mubi and Fandor and every other place we could think of. That's probably our best option, but we're not married to the idea, and we would love to hear. If there's something you think this segment could use, absolutely tell us. Let us know, and, you know, we will perhaps use your idea. So please suggest something like that if you have one. But in the meantime, we're just going to make do this week, at least. Allison, you're going first. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right, let's start with three new releases.
Okay, first up is Another Country. It is new on Hulu. This is a 1984 film starring Rupert Everett in probably one of his best roles as Guy Bennett, who is kind of based on the spy and double agent Guy Burgess, who was one of the Cambridge Five. The film also stars Colin Firth. And they play prefects at a school that is basically eaten. And it's about how they are in line to become the top two prefects, the gods. They're called gods. But it becomes like a really interesting look at the class system in England, kind of at that moment. And two characters who are, because they are, one is gay and the other is a Marxist, really don't see a place for themselves and kind of reject this class system. And so that is Another Country. It is new on Hulu. Also new on Hulu, My Sassy Girl, which is a 2001 Korean romantic comedy. There is an unfortunate 2008 American remake of this starring Jesse Bradford and Alicia Cuthbert that I do not recommend. But this I would. It's an interesting counterpoint to the idea of the manic pixie dream girl, because the main character is manic, but in an incredibly abusive, like amusingly abusive way. The lead male meets her on a subway platform where she's incredibly drunk, and he kind of rescues her. She vomits, and then they have this weird relationship, which she does things like pulls him out of class in college by telling the teacher he's the father of her soon-to-be aborted baby and other things. And they eventually kind of fall in love, and you understand why she's so nuts. But it's a kind of unusual and sometimes really amusingly cruel romantic comedy, and it's pretty fun. It's My Sassy Girl. It's on Hulu. And finally, Step Up to the Plate is a 2011 documentary that is new to Netflix. It's one I really like a lot. It's a food documentary. It's one of like three kind of like big gourmet food documentaries from last year, along with Jiro Dreams of Sushi and the one about El Bulli. And it's directed by Paul Lacoste and is about Michel Bras and his son Sebastian. And it's about how Michel is going to hand off his like famous, I think, three Michelin star restaurant or whatever. Three or two, whatever. The highest Michelin star rating.
Three is the highest.
Three is the highest. So he's going to hand it off to his son. And it's about how his son is preparing to deal with kind of like the difficulty of inheriting a restaurant from like someone famous, right? Like from a legacy that he has to kind of contend with. But the film is also just a great look at like how food can connect to personal history. There's a scene in which Sebastian kind of explains this dessert that he's been working on throughout the film and how it connects to different generations in his family that actually got me a little teary. Mm-hmm. And like it's a great look at both like dealing with a parent's legacy and also just how food gets intertwined with like personal history. So that's Step Up to the Plate. It is new on Netflix.
All right. Well, we can't do our expiring title. So how about one random film from your queue?
Yes. You gave me number 12, which is Funny Games, the 1998 Michael Haneke original film, not the American remake he did. Mm. It's one I've actually seen before, but not for a while. And I wanted to take another look at it so I can be lectured to about my, you know, enjoying violence on screen by Haneke.
What sort of mood would you have to be in to put it back
well,
on?
Well, you know,
it's been
sitting there, my queue, for a really long time. Yeah. So I am not sure, but that mood has yet to strike me. But, all you know, right. it's a kind of famous movie for a reason, and there are interesting things about it. It's not one that's really easy to pop on there for pleasure.
No.
All right, Matt, it's your turn now. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, three new films.
All right, I'm going to start off with The Dictator from 2012, directed by Larry Charles. It's available now on Netflix. This was the most recent Sacha Baron Cohen movie. Not entirely successful. But I thought it was kind of interesting, and I love Sacha Baron Cohen, and I think if you missed it, this is a good chance to catch up with it. You know, you've already got your Netflix subscription. You're not paying anything. He plays Aladdin, this dictator of this imaginary Middle Eastern country who is exiled and kind of overthrown, and he has to try to, he moves to Brooklyn, and he has this very awkward, hateful romance with Anna Faris, who I love, and she's fun in the movie. The movie is a mixed bag. It's interesting to kind of watch Sacha Baron Cohen try to marry his technique and his aesthetic with a more like a fictional movie. Like this one doesn't have the gotcha element to it or very little of it. It's much more a fiction movie. And it's interesting to see that work and not work. There is an amazing speech, though, at the end of this movie. He gives this impassioned speech, which I don't want to spoil in any way, but is kind of amazing and one of the more like powerful political moments in any recent movie. So that's The Dictator. It's available on Netflix. Available on Hulu is the movie Ride with the Devil from 1999, directed by Ang Lee. This is an underrated movie, I think. This is Ang Lee's Western. It was a huge flop when it came out. The cast is Tobey Maguire, Jewel, and Skeet Ulrich, which I think maybe people were not excited to see this Jewel and Skeet Ulrich Western, perhaps. Maybe they were quick to dismiss it for that. But it's actually a really good movie. It's since been put on the Criterion Collection, the director's cut. I haven't looked at the version on Hulu. I'm guessing this is the theatrical cut, which is the only version I've seen and enjoyed. I haven't even seen the director's cut yet. I've really wanted to check it out. But it's a movie about Maguire and Skeet Ulrich as friends during the Civil War, and it's sort of their relationship, and Jewel is sort of caught between them. It's a very interesting movie. It is worth watching. I think it might surprise you how good it is. You know, Ang Lee is a good director, but for some reason, this movie just didn't like connect with people. But I think it's worth checking out. That's Ride with the Devil. It's available on Hulu. Also available on Hulu is another sort of underrated movie that I kind of like. It's Psycho 2. Directed by Richard Franklin from 1983, and arguably there's never been a worse idea for a sequel than Psycho 2, and the end of the movie is kind of indefensible, I think. The last 20, 30 minutes of the movie just go completely off the rails, but the first hour of this movie is very interesting, and Anthony Perkins returns. He plays Norman Bates again, and, you know, I'm sure this was a cash-in kind of thing for him. I'm sure he was well paid to do this, but he gives a really good performance, you know, and it's sort of like Norman Bates gets out of the mental institution or wherever he's been, and he goes back to the Bates Motel, and he tries to start his life over, and it doesn't go all that well, and then, wouldn't you know it, Mama shows up somehow, and there's murders and intrigue, and not a great movie, but a very interesting sequel. If you're a fan of Psycho, and I suspect most of you are, and you feel like you'd be curious to see a sequel, take a look. See what you think. You might just enjoy it. That's Psycho 2, and it's available now on Hulu.
All right. One from your queue.
You gave me number 5, which is Red Lights, the supernatural thriller from Rodrigo Cortez, who I believe was the director of Buried. And I'm pretty sure we mentioned this one in Behind the Eight Ball when it came out on Netflix. And this is starring Robert De Niro, Sigourney Weaver, and Cillian Murphy. It's a story about paranormal investigators. And I think De Niro is like a psychic.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I have seen this one. It's got an amazing cast.
Right.
It doesn't really, I think there's a reason that it didn't kind of make more of an impact. But
I heard it's kind of interesting to start, but then
yes,
it falls apart.
It does. Yeah. But it has a really great beginning, actually.
That's what I've heard. And so this is why it's sort of on my queue. It's the one sort of thing where it's like, at some point I should at least check it out and give it a try. Much like you in Funny Games. It hasn't happened yet, but perhaps someday it will. So that's Red Lights, available on Netflix. Allison, are you ready to go through next episode's Listener's Choice options?
Yes.
We probably shouldn't even bother at this point, because we have one option that I would say I'm not 100% certain it's going to win, but I'm like 120% certain it's going to win. But we'll save that for last. What's the first option?
All right, the first option is Living in Oblivion, which is new on Crackle. This is a 1995 independent film directed by Tom DiCillo. And it's a film about filmmaking, about independent filmmaking specifically, and stars Steve Buscemi as the director, Nick Rev. And then also we got Catherine Keener, Dermot Mulroney, and James LeGros as a character by the name of Chad Palomino, who is supposed to be like a Hollywood star who's doing, you know, an indie film for cred. Who always, like, it was always rumored was based on Brad Pitt, though the director has denied this. But it's a really funny film. It's got some great kind of looks at the idea of independent film. So that is Living in Oblivion. It is on Crackle.
I've never seen that movie, and it's considered one of the great indies of the 90s. So I'm really, I would love to see it. I don't think I'm going to get the chance this week, but I would love to see it.
Seems unlikely. Yeah.
Option number two is a film I've been hearing mixed things about, but some very intense mixed things. So it's the sort of thing where some people love it and some people hate it, and that always is worth a look. The film is entitled Pieta, and it's available on iTunes and VOD. This is directed by Kim Ki-duk, the Korean filmmaker, was the winner of the Golden Lion at the 2012 Venice Film Festival. Kim Ki-duk has directed films like Bad Guy, Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring, Three Iron. The description says it's an intense and haunting story about a loan shark living an isolated and lonely existence who uses brutality to threaten and collect paychecks from desperate borrowers for his moneylender boss. One day, a mysterious woman appears in front of him claiming to be his long-lost mother, and the film goes from there. And again, it's gotten some mixed reviews, but some people think it's fantastic. Some people think it's maybe a little too intense or depressing. It's certainly, apparently, not a lighthearted film, not a pleasant, not a fun movie to watch, but good director, interesting subject matter. I would also be very interested to see this one as well. It's Pieta. It's available on iTunes and VOD. But we're not going to do that one either, Allison, because right. What's our third pick?
Well, our third pick is Arrested Development, because, you know, we have to talk about Arrested Development. It's Netflix's resurrection, in a way, of the 2003 to 2006 much-beloved, canceled comedy created by Mitchell Hurwitz about a wealthy family, the Bluths, and their many weird adventures as they're investigated for corruption, basically.
Light treason, as I recall.
Yes, light treason. Though sometimes they're like, it might be medium to heavy treason as the truth comes out.
Yeah.
It was a great show, and it's one that has basically been so mourned by its fans and felt so unjustly canceled that it has somehow managed to be brought back, you know, and all of the cast members, even though I'd say they're more famous by far now.
Oh, absolutely.
Come back and manage to come back for 15 new episodes. And I think what's particularly interesting about this is how they've tried to take advantage of the fact that all 15 episodes will be going live at once on May 26th at 12:01 Pacific time at midnight, just after midnight. But partially due to necessity, because it was hard to get everyone together again. You know, everyone's got more demands on their schedule now. But they've tried to use a different format from the TV show, that one that kind of makes sense in the streaming platform by having it tell different characters' storylines. So it follows each of the different characters and what they've been kind of up to in the time since the end of the show. And then, like, you get a sense of the whole as you watch it all. So I'm very curious about that. And also, I love Arrested Development, so I'm looking forward to it.
It's Arrested Development.
It's Arrested Development. So we kind of figured that'll win. But if you want to pleasantly surprise us also, not that we're regretting having to talk, we'd regret having to talk about it. But if you want to pleasantly surprise us by picking one of the other choices,
right,
please feel free to do that as well.
I mean, realistically, we're going to be watching the new Arrested Development either way.
Yes.
So it actually would be easy for us to do that. But it does seem like a gimme. But it's a gimme worth talking about, probably. All right. Well, which movie or TV show should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, May 27th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu, and you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on next week's episode, which will be on or ish Tuesday, June 4th.
FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the episode. The Film Spotting SVU remixed theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we will be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the review you pick. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/AllisonWilmore and /MattSinger. You can follow the show, which is at FilmSpottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, and where we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.